From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross.
He was my hero back when I was a kid. You let me down, but Chavo never once did.
Today, John Darnielle, the singer and songwriter behind the band The Mountain Goats, talks about his life and music. Darnielle's songs are like short stories. One album features autobiographical songs about growing up. Darnielle's stepfather abused him and his mother. In his teens, Darnielle used hard drugs and started deliberately cutting himself. After getting clean, he worked with troubled teenagers himself in mental health facilities. Darnielle's also a novelist. His latest, Wolf in White Van, is now out in paperback. And he has a recent album, Beat the Champ, about being a young fan of pro wrestling. Also, film critic David Edelstein reviews Sleeping with Other People. That's coming up on today's show.
Before we get back to Fresh Air, here's another podcast you might enjoy, especially if you spend a lot of time connected to screens and are wondering what all that screen time is doing to you. NPR's Guy Raz and the team at the TED Radio Hour are asking that question in a special two-part episode. You can listen to Screen Time on the TED Radio Hour beginning September 11th. You'll find it at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
Our guest, John Darnielle, is the founder, songwriter, and singer of The Mountain Goats. His lyrics are literary, often telling stories about fictional characters or stories straight from his life. In Spin magazine, Joe Gross describes Darnielle as one of rock's most prolific and devoutly worshipped songwriters. He's expanded beyond lyrics into novels. His first was about a teenaged boy in a psychiatric institution who's obsessed with heavy metal, particularly the Black Sabbath album Master of Reality. His most recent novel, Wolf in White Van, is now out in paperback. It's about a man who, at the age of 17, shot himself in the face with his father's rifle, expecting to die. He survives with chronic pain and a face so disfigured he seldom ventures into public, preferring to live in his head and his fantasies, inspired by heavy metal music and comic books like Conan the Barbarian. While recovering, he creates a fantasy game of his own, which leads to serious trouble. Darnielle not only writes about troubled teenagers, he used to work with them as an assistant nurse and counselor in psychiatric institutions. And he had his own share of trouble and alienation when he was a teenager, as we'll soon hear. Terry spoke with John Darnielle last fall when Wolf in White Van was published in hardback.
John Darnielle, welcome to Fresh Air. Let me ask you to start from a reading from Wolf in White Van. This is the adult version of the character talking about people's reaction to his disfigured face.
Nobody ever asks me if they can look at my face, except doctors and nurses, I mean. People do look at it quite often, but usually only if they can convince themselves that I won't notice they're looking. They try not to let their eyes stop wandering when they look over in my direction. They pose, as if they were surveying some broader scene. I understand a little the social dictate to not stare at misshapen people. You want to spare their feelings. You don't want them to feel ugly. At the same time, though, even before I became what I am, I used to wonder, isn't it okay to stare if something seems to stand out? Why not stare? My own perspective is probably tainted by having spent long hours before mirrors after the accident. It would be pretty hard to make me feel ugly. Words like pretty and ugly exist in a different vocabulary from the one you might invent to describe a face that had to be put back together by a team of surgeons. My face is strange and terrible. It merits a little staring.
That's John Darnielle reading from his new novel, Wolf in White Van. Thanks for reading that. What did you want to make your main character, someone who as a teenager survived a self-inflicted gunshot in the face and has to live with the physical and psychological consequences, including pain and a face so disfigured he rarely ventures out in public?
Well, I started without that idea. I started just writing a scene with a bunch of teenagers at high school smoking cigarettes, the one in the last chapter. And it wasn't going anywhere in particular. I was just sort of trying to write a scene that was familiar to me because I used to go across the parking lot at Claremont High and smoke cigarettes with the metal kids. And when I sat down to write the morning I started it, I was writing that chapter, the last one, and I had no sense of where I was going, no outline. I had the title already because I really liked that title, but I wasn't sure what I was going to do. And then as it ramped up toward this ending scene, it was sort of getting away from me. And then the thing that happened. And I thought, well, as a short story, that's not very good, right? That's like sort of a very very beginner's move in a short story to have it end with somebody dying. So I thought, well, he shouldn't be dead then. What should happen? And that's when I got the idea to trace backwards to that moment. And then I started asking myself questions in the way that improvisational comedians do. You know, okay, well, what does he do for a living? What does he wear? Who are his friends? How does he make any money? What does he wish he was? And all those sorts of things. And that performative element is sort of how I wrote the book, by just asking myself questions about, well, then what happens then? You know, what if this happens, then what?
Your character has survived a self-inflicted gunshot wound.
Right.
He says it was an accident. It'd be hard to do that to your face with a rifle.
he calls it the accident.
Yeah.
It's an accident insofar as he sort of got caught in a sequence of movement that sort of ran ahead of him. So it's not – he didn't have a premeditated plan until that evening, right? So it's an accident. And also I think there's a moment where he talks about he and his parents settling on the word the accident in order to refer to it.
Did you know people who had survived a suicide attempt but were left in a physically compromised or disfigured state afterwards?
No, I know a lot of people who've survived suicide attempts, but nobody whose attempt is sort of advertised to the world like that. But there were, of course, James Vance and Ray Belknap, the two teenagers who shot themselves after listening to Judas Priest a lot, and then their parents sued Judas Priest. Do you remember this story?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So that was the jumping off part, because one of them survived the pact, and his parents, or if there wasn't a real pact as far as I know, but his parents sued Judas Priest, who had to come to Reno to appear to defend their music. And backwards masking was the main trope in this trial. And I thought about all that, about things moving backwards and trying to extract sense from things by running them backwards, and that was sort of an inspiring point.
Right, the backwards trope you're talking about is the Christians who maintain that if you play heavy metal records backwards, you hear the messages that Satan has embedded in them because he's
using...
Or
that the artist is embedded. Yeah,
the artist is sometimes a messenger of Satan, aren't they?
Yes, on behalf of Satan.
Yes. So your character in this novel has had a lot of trouble functioning in the world. As a teenager, he's lived in the fantasies created by others, like Conan the Barbarian comics.
Right.
And when he is slowly recovering from his self-inflicted gunshot wound, he creates a game of his own. And this is in the pre-internet era, so this is like a mail-by-mail game where...
Right.
People mail in their next move and he mails in what they're supposed to do next. And the scenario is it's a kind of desolate future and a radiated world, and they have to go from one place to another through these ordeals seeking shelter. And the people who play it are people who, like the main character, don't feel comfortable in the world as it is, and they need to retreat to a fantasy world, whether that's heavy metal or video games, or the game that this character creates. And I'm wondering if that was your case when you were a teenager, that you seriously needed a world to retreat to.
Sure, it was music for me. I mean, it was, and I think it's true for so many. I mean, I think when you first start to discover which music is yours and which speaks to you, you know, I think whatever your life is like, you experience that very, very deeply. You know, and everyone remembers the music of their teenage years, I think, with a special fondness. And I think part of that's because you're just discovering the power of this amazing art form. And yeah, I mean, I had a pair of Nova 30 headphones that were my life raft. Is I would put them on and you could disappear into, you know, Lou Reed's Rock and Roll Animal was a big one I would go under. Or early Genesis records, I confess, with a little chagrin.
And did you have comic books too?
I was a huge comic book fan. My dude was the Incredible Hulk. That was my hero.
Why?
The guy who, I get kind of emotional when I think about it, because the Incredible Hulk was fiercely loyal to people who had treated him well. It was the one major value in his life was he valued and treasured his friends, and that anyone who mistreated them he wanted to destroy utterly, not just to punish but to pulverize. And when he was angry. Then he or upset in any other way, but when his emotions were too strong, he was transformed into this creature who destroyed, and that was beautiful. I mean, it's like, because it's how you feel when you have a very strong feeling of resentment or anger and you can't do anything with it. You wish you could make people see, you know, just how powerful it feels. You feel like if it were unleashed, it would break things, right? And the Incredible Hulk is that just made flesh. He spoke in the third person about himself in a very charming way to me. I thought he was the best. And actually, when they took that away from him, I think that was when I became very disenfranchised with comics. It's like they had him start speaking more like General Thunderbolt Ross, you know, kind of like an army guy. And I was like, no. I need my Hulk to be talking about himself in the third person and to be of below average intelligence. That's important to me.
So did you want that power to punish? To punish people who mistreated you or mistreated those close to you?
I don't know that I wanted to wield the power so much as I wanted them to see what it felt like to want that. You know, it's like in your better moments, obviously you don't want to hurt anybody, you know. But you have this point of rage and powerlessness where you think, I wish you could see what it feels like this anger could do to a person, you know, and you have those moments of contact with it where it feels, and this is illusory, of course. If you share, William Blake talks about this, if you just let it go, if you say, this is how I feel, it dissipates, you know. But when if you don't have a way of doing that, if doing that will have consequences that you can't shoulder, then it sits there and festers and starts to sort of glow. and yeah, that was the feeling. Is like, you know, if this comes out, it will level cities, you know.
Yeah, and you have characters in two novels who have that kind of rage.
Yes, it was a very heavy feeling for me that I carried for a long time.
And I presume that was in part because you had a stepfather who abused you and your mother.
It was. I think the more I dig, the more I think that's like that's important. But so is the fact that, you know, that my parents divorced when I was five, which is like, you know, there's a lot bigger problems to have. But a lot of that stuff, the having to move around a lot, feeling uprooted when stability is so important for children. I think some of that is also maybe weighs just as heavily. I mean, but obviously it was a chaotic environment that I was a child in, and it makes you angry after a while.
So I want to play one of your songs. And
yeah.
This is a song. This is one of your better known songs. It's called The Best Ever Death Metal Band Out of Denton. And it's a song about, you know, teenagers who are in a like garage heavy metal band.
Yeah.
And want to be stars. Do you want to say anything about writing this?
I hadn't thought about that stuff in a while, but I used to work at a short-term adolescent facility in the 80s during the time when parents were often blaming music for their adolescence troubles. And I felt very deeply for these kids because I think that contact with music is sacred, and it's what, you know, it's what can carry you through the hard times. So yeah, I mean, it's a song that has a funny setup, but I mean it a lot.
Okay, so let's hear it. So this is The Mountain Goats. This is John Darnielle performing The Best Ever Death Metal Band Out of Denton.
The best ever death metal band out of Denton with a couple of guys who'd been friends since grade school. One was named Cyrus, the other was Jeff, and they practiced twice a week in Jeff's bedroom. Best ever death metal band out of Denton. Never settled on a name, but the top three contenders after weeks of debate were Satan's Fingers and the Killers and the Hospital Bombers. Believed in their hearts they were headed for stage lights and Lear jets and fortune and fame. So in script that made prominent use of a pentagram, they stenciled their drumheads and guitars with their names. And this was how Cyrus got sent to the school where they told him he'd never be famous. And this was why Jeff, in the letters he'd write to his friend, helped develop a plan to get even. When you punish a person for dreaming his dream, don't expect him to thank or forgive you. The best ever death metal band out of Denton will in time both outpace and outlive you. Hail Satan! Hail Satan! Tonight, hail Satan!
So that's the Mountain Goats. My guest is John Darnielle, who's the singer-songwriter of the band, founder of the band. sometimes the solo member of the band. And that was the song, the best ever death metal band out of Denton. Lots of satanic imagery in heavy metal.
Yeah.
Were you into that? Like, what did satanic imagery mean to you? What did religion mean to you? Because in order for Satan to have power, religion has to have power, you know.
Right, sure. No, you have to, if you believe in Satan, then you believe in God.
And you believe in a Christian God.
Sure. Well, I think there's devils in other, but the
right.
idea of this single malevolent radical personified force of Satan, right? I think that's uniquely Christian. If not uniquely Christian, that's the one we usually think of, right? It's like the king of all the personified evil gods, right? So, but when I was a kid, I went to Catholic school before the divorce, and I was just really attracted to this religious thinking. But there's always that. It's so pretentious to quote Baudelaire, but the shimmer of evil, right? You know, you hear about the evil things. They don't want to instruct you in them. You know, there's no benefit in that. But at the same time, so that these forbidden things that sort of call to you from the distance, and those are the ones, you know, that you want to have a harder look at. And that was something that as a child I was really curious about to an almost morbid point, you know, like the idea that you could – that there was a world behind the world, that like that this was only the part you could see. And the idea that the other one might be harmful was terrifying to me and at the same time irresistibly attractive. And so when I was 13, I became one of the most tiresome atheists on the planet, and I was carrying Nietzsche around my junior high. But but prior to that, I used to think about the devil a lot. You know, I was like and think about when you would hear about devil worshippers, right? How could somebody want to ally themselves with somebody whose entire nature compels him to do you harm? And yet people are said to worship him. And that was the sort of idea that as a young man, I couldn't get my head entirely around. Or understand the concept of the devil as a principle rather than a being. And so yeah, it was infinitely appealing to me. At the same time, I was afraid to approach it too much.
Since Satan is a kind of prominent figure in some heavy metal music.
Yes, a lot, yeah.
And certainly interpreted as being a prominent figure in heavy metal music by Christian groups who have
sure.
opposed it over the years. Did your interest in this like other possible world and in the devil play in at all to your interest in metal or in extreme music?
I think actually my interest in metal comes from a different place insofar as I wasn't into it. It was another thing where when I first heard the term and I heard it, well, this is a very loud music. It's much louder than other musics than I wanted to know about this extreme music. But it wasn't what I naturally gravitated to. So when I'd meet metal kids, I was really curious, what is it about the music you like that makes it work for you? And that was around the time of The Number of the Beast by Iron Maiden and Peace of Mind, right? And after the, you know, I mean, AC/DC still sort of counted as heavy metal at that time. And it wasn't the demonic stuff that attracted me then, because by then I was reading, you know, I was reading poetry that liked to talk about the devil. But the thing about metal that attracted me then was the energy and the total lack of guile. Metal sort of, it has its own code of cool, but it's not really trying to be cool, you know, and that was very refreshing to me, that metal is very much about expressing something that seems awesome to you, even if at the time, you know, much of the world was going to mock and reject it, you know.
So you have, your first novel is on that a series of short books called 33 and a Third, in which somebody
right.
writes a tribute to their favorite album, but you did yours as fiction. And so
right.
yours is through the voice of a teenager who's in a mental health facility and is obsessed with the Black Sabbath album, Master of Reality.
Right.
So the book is all about his obsession with that, and he gives a kind of track-by-track disquisition about what each
right,
track
right.
means and what Ozzy Osbourne symbolizes and so on. And so, like, the satanic imagery really means something to him. And I know since you worked at a mental health facility and worked with teenagers there, did you find that in some of the teenagers, that satanic imagery really kind of connected to them for whatever reason?
No, most of the teenagers who wanted to do Satan stuff that I knew were doing it specifically to make the adults jump, right? That was the main thing is, like, if you find an adult who really believes that a Satan exists, who wants to steal your soul, right, and you say Satan to that adult with a particular look on your face, you can get a giant rise out of that adult, right? Satan is an awesome weapon in that case because these people who really strongly believe that, if they see you talking about how you want to worship Satan or whatever, it's sort of like if you're working with 2-year-olds, right, and a 2-year-old finds out what really bothers you, well, he's extraordinarily excited to have this power now, you know, and he'll just keep doing the thing that bothers you because it's nice to be able to have that kind of control, right? And for most of the teenagers who were into that stuff that I knew, it was about 100%, watch how people react when I do this.
John Darnielle, founder of the band The Mountain Goats, speaking last year with Terry Gross. His novel, Wolf in White Van, is now out in paperback. He'll be back after a break. Here's a track from Beat the Champ, the latest Mountain Goats CD. Many of the songs are about professional wrestling. This one is called The Legend of Chavo Guerrera. I'm Dave Davies. This is Fresh Air.
Born down in El Paso, where the tumbleweeds blow, to the middleweight champ of all Mexico. Dad fought many bloody battles, and he raised four sons. Chavo was the oldest one. Old man Gory could pop like a live grenade. Raised his boys in the way of the trade. Hector and Mondo, young Eddie G. Chavo meant the most to me. Look high, it's my last hope. Chavo Guerrero, coming off the top rope. He came from Texas seeking fortune and fame. Rose pretty quickly to the top of the game. Defender of the downtrodden, king of the hill. Tag team champion with Al Madrill. Before a black and white TV in the middle of the night. I'm lying on the floor, I'm bathed in blue light. The telecast's in Spanish, I can understand some, and I need justice in my life. Here it comes. Look high, is my last hope. Chavo Guerrero, coming off the top rope. Red Shoes Dugan, holding his arm high, all out of breath. I hated all of
support for Fresh Air comes from TIAA Craft, a financial services company dedicated to helping clients achieve lifelong financial well-being. A global asset manager with award-winning performance, TIAA CREF was founded nearly a century ago to serve those who serve others in the academic, medical, cultural, governmental, and research fields. Its investment model and long-term approach are aimed at delivering outcomes that benefit clients. TIAA CREF, created to serve and built to perform at TIAA.org.
I'd like to play another song.
Cool.
And this is from an album that's pretty autobiographical. And a lot of the songs on this album relate to the abuse that your father meted out.
My stepfather.
Stepfather. Thank you for correcting me.
Mm-hmm.
And so the song I want to play is called Dance Music. Would you introduce it for us?
This is a song called Dance Music that takes place during two disparate points of my life. And the first one I'm five, and the divorce is fresh, and we just moved across town. And it was when I first started to notice sort of cracks in the edifice of the new home. And then the next one, the second half of the song, I'm a teenager, and I'm sort of exploring my own ways of wrecking myself.
and your anger at your stepfather for doing things like throwing glasses at your mother's head.
Yeah, and I don't want to sort of localize it entirely there. It's like there's also, I'm becoming a person who, owing to the last 10 years or so of experience, has really learned to internalize stuff and is taking stuff out on himself.
Okay, so let's hear Dance Music. This is the Mountain Goats, which is the band led by my guest, John Darnielle.
All right, I'm on Johnson Avenue in San Luis Obispo, and I'm 5 years old or six maybe, and indications that there's something wrong with our new house. Trip down the wire twice daily. I'm in the living room watching the Watergate hearings while my stepfather yells at my mother, launches a glass across the room straight at her head, and I dash upstairs to take cover, lean in close to my little record player on the floor. So this is what the volume knob's for. I listen to dance music. Dance music. Okay, so look, I'm 17 years old, and you're the last best thing I got going. But then the special secret sickness starts to eat through you. What am I supposed to do? No way of knowing, so I follow you down your twisting alleyways, find a few cul-de-sacs of my own.
one place this road ever ends up, and I don't want to die alone. Let me down, let me down, let me down gently. When the police come to get me, I'm listening to dance music. Dance music.
So that's Dance Music by my guest John Darnielle. He wrote the song and sings it, and his band is called The Mountain Goats. And this is from a pretty autobiographical album.
Yeah.
That was released in, what, 2005?
2005, yeah.
So what happens in the song is, like, you retreat and go upstairs and put on your headphones, which you told us before is what you used
right.
to do. There's also a scene within the song, and I say a scene because your songs kind of are like little stories. There's a scene where you or your character at age 17 is in his room when the police come to get him. And
I'm actually in a car.
You're in a car. I'm sorry.
I don't know if I specified in the song. It's a real scene, so I'm actually in a car.
Yeah, well, that's what I was wondering. And were you like doing drugs? Was that the issue?
So without naming any names, my girlfriend and I had gotten into really hard drugs and heroin. And we were doing it a lot and enjoying it. And we pulled up to her house one evening after an evening out, pretty high, I think. And she said, and I remember the phrasing because it was unusual, "What's a police doing at my house?" Right. And her mom had discovered our stuff and had called the police, which is the right thing to do, I want to say, in retrospect. but at the time, we were pretty angry. And we listened at the time to the Sisters of Mercy and other dancey goth stuff. But so that's what's going on, is sort of there's this moment after when you're taking a lot of drugs, you go through these periods of feeling like you're golden and nothing can touch you, and the police are stupid and they can't catch you and all this kind of stuff. And then, of course, at the moment when one of them taps on your window, all of that just crumbles. Right? And so that's that moment.
Okay. At the risk of sounding stupid here, how does a 17-year-old like you, who is, you know, deeply into literature and music and really smart, though really unhappy at home, how does someone like you end up doing heroin? Because you're smart enough to know how dangerous it is.
Oh, but no, I mean, your intelligence doesn't override your desire to destroy yourself. You know, it's like, I really, really, I did not want to be in my own skin. I really wanted to get high and stay high, you know. And I also had this fear of going too far. Every time it's like, I know people who got way, way closer to the edge than I did. Any opportunity to check out of daily consciousness was welcome for me then.
But you say it was also an instinct to destroy yourself.
Oh, sure. Yeah. No, it's kind of plainly what it is. It's like, especially if you're using needles, it's like every single time you do it, you're jabbing something into your vein. You know, it's like visually you can see you are attacking your own body. But I was into all that kind of stuff, you know, and self-mutilation and.
So I have to ask you about self-mutilation. You know, it's something I guess I've really wanted to understand, and I think I don't quite get it. I'm so pain-averse. I'm very, very pain-averse. So I don't really understand the urge to inflict pain on yourself.
Well, I want to say that I'm not a doctor, I can't really speak authoritatively about this. My suspicion is that it's different for everybody, that you can't speak monolithically about why people do that. And I think actually this is one major problem in the treatment of younger people, is there's this assumption that there's a model on which you can treat everybody, and everybody's different. You know, I mean, and everybody's different is such a facile truism that I think we say, well, of course everybody's different. Now, where's the generality that I can apply to everybody? But there isn't one. But for me, I mean, this is hard to explain if you're pain-averse. It hurt bad and that felt good, in part because it's about controlling pain, right? It's about remaining in control. I get to do this. I say where my limits are, you know.
What is it that you did to yourself?
Oh, I feel really weird. It's interesting, Kevin, because I never talk about this. I carried a razor around in my wallet, a sharp razor, and when things would get really rough in my head, I would just go cut my arms or legs.
And did people know you were doing that?
My girlfriend did. I think I was in a lot of denial about who knew what back then. But yeah, I mean, my friends knew. They didn't like it. But I think that's part of the appeal if you're 16, is like, you know, your friends don't like it. And you say, yes, but it's my body and I'll do what I like with it. Right? And I think that's what it's about, or at least was for me, is stating that my body belongs to me and I will do what I like with it, whether anyone likes it or not.
You had said before that your girlfriend's parents did the right thing when they found your needles.
Yeah.
And called the police. So what was the outcome of the police showing up and finding you?
We didn't have anything in the car, so they couldn't do anything. They had to leave. They yelled at us and called us names and were really unpleasant, and they had to leave.
And then?
Then we kept right on at it. I overdosed later that summer. I woke up handcuffed to the bed.
Handcuffed by who?
The police. Well, the police or the staff, I'm not sure. I think I had become violent under the influence of the opiate antagonist they put in me, which I think was Narcan, but I'm not sure. And they'd also they'd put activated charcoal in my lungs. And so I guess when some combination of whatever they were trying to do to resuscitate me kicked in, I got really violent, and so they handcuffed me to the bed. And that's how I woke up. I don't know how many days later, but I tried to move my wrist. And I did decide it was sort of time for me to – I didn't want to die. You know, it was like – I thought that I did until I was close enough, and then I knew I needed to change things a little bit. I mean, I didn't want to stop using drugs, and I didn't stop using drugs, but I wanted to stop using heroin daily, and I did.
So you say you decided you didn't want to die. Before,
I think so.
Before
I mean,
that,
I wouldn't
you weren't
have put
so sure?
I don't think – I mean, I think if you'd have asked me at either point, I would have said I wanted to die, but not right then. And so it's like I wanted to destroy myself. It's hard. I mean, this does tie into the book. It's like I really wanted to destroy myself, but I wasn't ready. Either I was afraid, you know, or the thought of how angry it would make my friends who were always counseling me against doing it, because I talked about it constantly. It was like I never shut up about suicide back then. And and my friends would, you know, I had some who were saying, you know, no, it's you can't do that. So whatever combination of things, you know, and whatever enjoyment I was also bringing from life, because I don't like to say this, but it was an exciting time. You know, it's like I was doing the things that were dangerous and tasting that rare air of doing dangerous things.
So when you were working at a mental health facility, working with teenagers there, I'm sure some of them must have been suicide survivors or teenagers who had flirted with the idea of suicide. Was it therapeutic for you to be with them and to be the older person and to be, you know, more of the authority figure, more of the adult, more of the person who was there to help and guide them as the person, as opposed to the person who was in danger of giving into that kind of urge themselves?
I mean, possibly sometimes, but you want to be careful not to be using your work as a caregiver as something therapeutic for you, right? I go to a therapist for that.
Oh, that's such a good point.
Right. As a caregiver, I'm not there to take care of myself, and it is not a patient's responsibility to take care of any of my stuff, right? And so,
yes.
So I'd always try to keep myself out of it. You would occasionally meet a patient once in 7 years, you'd want to go, I'm going to disclose something here because I want you to know that I see a little something of my younger self in you. But generally speaking, you know, the parameters of working involve checking yourself at the door. You still bring you. The self is a giant thing, right? But the self who needs help and the self who needs to be healed and repaired, that's the guy you need to leave in the car when you pull in the parking lot of the facility, because those patients have their own problems. They don't need to be helping you.
Let's hear more music. The song I want to play is called No Children. This is about a fictional couple that you wrote many songs about.
Yes.
They do not have a good relationship.
No.
The refrain in...
Define good.
The refrain in this song is, I hope you die. I hope we both die.
Yes.
This is a pretty angry song.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me a little bit about this couple and about the point their relationship is in at the point of this song.
So this may take a minute. I want to do the genesis of where I got to these people and then tell you about them. So I was reading a lot of poetry when I was 21. I was really into John Berryman, and so impressed by the idea of making some project where you had the same character that you did 400 poems about. You know, you really live with this person and become and house this person. And I got this idea to write about a divorcing couple because I grew up in Southern California, and it really seemed like the defining fact of so many of my friends' lives was the divorce of their parents. It was like this was a thing that wasn't strange for us, that I think, you know, in other parts of the country might have been stranger, and certainly a generation or two before, it was a big deal. But for us, it was par for the course. Your parents, if they're not divorced now, they're going to get divorced a little later. And I thought about divorce a lot and what it meant, you know, what it had meant to our house, what it meant to other friends. You have friends whose parents are divorcing when they're teenagers, and you know, that's sort of like a wrecking ball just coming into the world that seemed stable for them. And so I wanted to write about divorce, and I wanted to write from the point of view of an alcoholic couple. And I had this vision of them just fleeing toward at the time I was in recovery, and there's a thing they talk about doing a geographical, right? Moving someplace to get away from your problems, right? But you can't run away from yourself, so you'll still be there. And it's sort of the lesson they continue not learning as they flee across the bottom of the country and wind up in Tallahassee. When they get to Tallahassee, that's when they run out of road, and so they live in the same decaying house, and that's when all their problems start to collapse on them. By the time we get to know children, they're just fighting all the time. And they're fairly honest with each other, which is their one saving grace.
Okay, so this is a song written and sung by my guest, John Darnielle, from Mountain Goat's album, Tallahassee. It's called No Children.
I hope that our few remaining friends give up on trying to save us. I hope we come up with a fail-safe plot to piss off the dumb few that forgave us. I hope the fences we mended fall down beneath their own weight, and I hope we hang on past the last exit. I hope it's already too late, and I hope the junkyard a few blocks from here someday burns down, and I hope the rising black smoke carries me far away, and I never come back to this town again. In my life, I hope I lie and tell everyone you were a good wife, and I hope you die. I hope we both die. I hope I cut myself shaving tomorrow. I hope it bleeds all day long. Our friends say it's darkest before the sun rises. We're pretty sure they're all wrong. I hope it stays dark forever. I hope the worst isn't over. And I hope you blink before I do. And I hope I never get sober. And I hope when you think of me years down the line, you can't find one good thing to say. And I'd hope that if I found the strength to walk out, you'd stay the hell out of my way. I am drowning. There is no sign of land. You are coming down with me, hand in unlovable hand, and I hope you die. I hope we both die.
That's No Children from the Mountain Goats album, Tallahassee. My guest is John Darnielle, who's the founder, songwriter, and singer of the Mountain Goats. He's also a novelist, and his new novel, Wolf in White Van, has just been published. So the kind of shelter that you found in music when you were young and very unhappy, do you have fans who find that kind of shelter in your music now?
Yes. I mean, it feels presumptuous to say yes. It's like, but I know because they tell me that what I do is useful to them, and this is an honor so profound that I don't know how to talk about it. It's I mean, how often does a person get to feel like, well, this was worth living for, this was worth coming this way for, you know? But that's how I feel about that. It's like music was all to me, and it's incredible to me that I can make things that people can use in that way.
I imagine that people who really relate to the music want to share their story. They feel probably like they've heard yours, they get yours, and it relates to theirs, and they want to tell you theirs. What's that like for you, hearing a lot of people's very difficult, maybe sometimes even tragic stories?
It's an honor, you know. It's like, it can be very heavy, you know. I mean, it's like, it's a funny thing to say since I'm doing interviews to promote a book and stuff, but it's like, it makes me glad I'm not really famous. You know what I mean? It's like, because I think I'm not the only person who writes music that's really useful to people and that people are able to use in times of severe trial. And I think at some point, you know, people must reach a point where they say, well, I've had so many stories shared with me it's very intense. It's very, because I hang out and sign records for an hour or 2 hours every night, and I like to hear as many people's stories as I can, because if somebody wants to share their story with me, I want to honor that, you know. But you do reach a point where it's like, well, one person, for them, they're sharing their story and then they're going to go home. But if you are hearing a bunch of them, it gets very intense. It's a lot, you know. But I mean, I want to, for one thing, I kind of have this feeling like, I can handle this, you know. And the other thing is I feel a duty. You know, it's like there's people choose to engage my music, because when I say if I make something people can use, I really think there's a lot of music that you can use to heal and save yourself. It's not like I have some magic power and I reached inside somebody and said, oh, you didn't know this about yourself until I wrote this song. That's not true, right? What I did was I made a thing, and somebody who needed to find something found mine and chose to meet me out on that ground. It's this sort of area of communication that's unique to music, I think. There's a lot of it that has nothing to do with me. You know, the person who chooses to use that attaches it to their own life as they see fit. I mean, you can hear from this, like, it's very intense to have those sorts of conversations, to have people sharing stuff that maybe is secret. But, I mean, I try to be worthy of it. You know, it's an honor. I've worked a lot of jobs. This is the best one.
John Darnielle, thank you so much for talking with us.
Of course. Thank you.
John Darnielle is founder, singer, and songwriter of The Mountain Goats. The group's latest album is Beat the Champ. Darnielle's also a novelist. His latest, Wolf in White Van, is out in paperback. Coming up, David Edelstein reviews the new film Sleeping with Other People. This is Fresh Air.
Before we get back to Fresh Air, here's another podcast you might enjoy, especially if you spend a lot of time connected to screens and are wondering what all that screen time is doing to you. NPR's Guy Raz and the team at the TED Radio Hour are asking that question in a special two-part episode. You can listen to Screen Time on the TED Radio Hour beginning September 11th. You'll find it at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
The sex comedy Sleeping with Other People is the second feature by sometime playwright Leslie Headland, who made the dark 2012 female ensemble comedy Bachelorette. The new film stars Alison Brie, best known as Trudy Campbell in the TV series Mad Men, and Jason Sudeikis of Saturday Night Live and the hit movie Horrible Bosses. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
Sleeping with Other People has the arc of a conventional mainstream rom-com, but the beats are scrambled, and the movie gets a climactic event out of the way in the prologue. The film actually opens with the male and female protagonists having sex, taking each other's virginity. We first see Alison Brie's Lainey as a college student pounding drunkenly on the door of a teaching assistant she has a crush on. Another student, Jake, played by Jason Sudeikis, steps in to keep her getting thrown out of the dorm. Having met Cute, they bond, sleep together, and separate for more than a decade. When they bump into each other again, it's at a meeting for sex addicts and people who can't be faithful. A second meet cute. Writer-director Leslie Headland has said in interviews that she holed up to write the film after the release of her raunchy first feature, Bachelorette. That movie did okay, not great, but when it faded from view and she ended a relationship, she went into an emotional dark time. Sleeping with Other People has a headlong quality, as if it's gushing from the brain of someone who saw When Harry Met Sally 10 times, and is furiously reworking the template to fit her own reality, adding more casual sex and emotional weirdness, and roughening the edges. Lainey destroys every relationship by cheating with that same teaching assistant she didn't find in the first scene. He's now a twerp of a doctor, played by Adam Scott, with a caterpillar mustache, and it's clear he's just using her. Jake compulsively cheats on girlfriends, too, and his attempts to explain why are so convoluted you can barely focus on the words. But rather than falling into bed in the course of their reunion, Lainey and Jake see another design for living.
We got to just be friends.
Yes, that is the mature, responsible thing to do for each other and ourselves. Yes, I agree. Okay, but then we got to come up with a system. If we're going to be friends, you know, and I want it to be good friends, but we got to have
fair.
A system here.
So maybe we come up with a safe word for if we're having sexual tension, and then we'll stop
whatever
is creating.
So if you're doing something sexy, or I'm doing something sexy.
If we're feeling attracted,
okay, but it's mutual, so it is mutual.
The word.
You're saying it's mutual.
It could be mutual.
That's a yes.
I may or
That's
may not
yes.
need to use the word. We'll have to see in
okay,
the future.
Okay, well, all right. Well, let's, all
happens?
Right.
Say, we'll
safe
say,
word.
Yeah,
let's go.
Anything.
Come up with one. What do you got? I'll do anything. What do you, would you pick it, and yes.
It's avocado.
No, can't do that.
No.
No,
it,
no.
It's just immediate veto.
Mm-mm. Well, I mean, it's too sexual. It's too sexual.
Avocado is too sexual.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, you got to see the way I eat an avocado. You'd be like, that's, I, you know, do that to me.
You can hear it in that scene, right? In Sleeping with Other People, Lainey and Jake are so on with each other. They trade quips like bebop lines, picking up on each other's last notes and building on the theme. They're so good a fit, it's hard to know why they're not together or why they didn't date after their first momentous encounter. But the safe word they do settle on tells you much about how they see sex. It's mousetrap. The actors give it everything. Alison Brie pops her saucer eyes and all but sings her lines. When she conspires with Jake about his various lovers, she drops her voice so that it's full of husky irony. And then, when Lainey is excited, she lets it fly up into a demented tinkle. Sudeikis has never been so appealing. His Jake is the sort of funny, attentive guy whose vibe suggests he really likes women, even if he doesn't. Or doesn't know what he likes, which makes him dangerous to any woman who falls for him. Hedlund supplies the leads with a great group of confidants. Jason Mantzoukas is the family man with whom Jake invents a piece of software that will make them millions. And he and Andrea Savage, as his wife, are such a funny Greek chorus that they get almost the entire closing credit sequence to riff. Amanda Peet plays the head of the company that makes Jack rich and the object of his romantic attentions. Her final scene is harsh and angry and doesn't fit into the standard rom-com template, to which I say, good. No studio wanted to make Sleeping with Other People. It's an indie film produced by Adam McKay and Will Ferrell, along with Jessica Elbaum, who runs their production company. That's enough to disturb the sleep of anyone who longs for mainstream Hollywood comedies with dissonant, messy emotions and what we used to call sexual frankness. But I think movie lovers' relationship with Leslie Hedlund could be a lasting one.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. On Monday's Fresh Air, we talk with Scott Shane, national security reporter for The New York Times, about the radical cleric Anwar al-Awlaki, who was assassinated in a U.S. drone strike 4 years ago. Awlaki has become a martyr and an inspiration for would-be jihadists. Shane's new book is Objective Troy, A Terrorist, A President, and the Rise of the Drone. Hope you can join us then. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.